March 11th, 1979, talking to Gladys Start and Ruby. Well, yesterday we had finished with talking about Fairbanks and that you really liked Fairbanks and were going to go to Chico. And I was wondering, just before we talk a little bit about Chico, what it was that you liked about Fairbanks. And, you know, the kind of feelings that you had when you left, I guess, like, did you intend to come back to Fairbanks?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned that I had worked full-time in Fairbanks while I was going to school. And I worked in the telegraph office. It was the Alaska Communication System in those days. And because of the type of work, I got to know many people in Fairbanks. And the reason I liked Fairbanks so much in the 40s, it was still a small-town atmosphere. You got to know everybody. They were very friendly. It was that type of open-door hospitality. And our only reason for leaving Alaska, and we only left for the school year, was because of the small education department at the university. There was only one professor on the staff there then, and we just didn't feel like we were being adequately trained for the profession. And they had a visiting professor from Chico State at the university that came for summer sessions, and she was a vivacious personality. And we also had a friend who was a student at the university whose home was in Chico, and he told us about Chico State. But when the decision came that we would have to go elsewhere to finish our education, we did a lot of writing to various universities outside, and even then we decided on Chico State. And we went to Chico State for 3 years. But I had started out in secondary education, and we were married in 50 and immediately began raising our family, so we had small children, and my interest turned to elementary education. So by the time I finished college, I had considerably more credits than necessary for my degree because of the different requirements.
So you were finishing school and raising a family at the same time?
Mm-hmm. Right. We had, when I graduated in mid-year or in January of 54, we had Diane and Johnny, and I was expecting Jimmy then. So Johnny was born in Chico, our second year there. And we were back in Alaska, so Jim was born in Fairbanks in 54, in August of 54.
What was that like for you, trying to get an education and raise children at the same time?
Well, actually, academically, I did my best when I had the most responsibilities at home and a heavy schedule at school. The only straight A year I did have in college was that year when I did my practice teaching, took night classes, had the two small children at home, was expecting the third, and then we also had two nephews that stayed with us that year. But necessity demanded organization, where if I would have been single and attending college, much of that time would have been spent social activities in a more lax schedule. That year, I was just pinned to a very close schedule. Then besides that, because we were outside, we also had family visiting us, both Chuck's mother and my father and mother. Plus a few extra friends that came floating through.
Did Chuck help out on some of the chores then? Was there sharing going on about that? How is that organized?
There always has been sharing. There hasn't been any labor divided by, you know, the role of man and woman in our household. Chuck is a better cook than I am, for example, and he's very good with child raising. Also, we did have to make certain formal arrangements. We just worked very well without planning any kind of division about you do this. You just, whoever happened to be there did it. Except the only time I remember going through any kind of a discussion about you do this type of thing was when I was expecting John. And there were 18 months difference between Diane and John. And we were both going to school. And we made the arrangement where if Diane woke up during the night, Chuck would wake up to take care of her. And Johnny, of course, would wake up because I was nursing him. Then I would wake up and take care of him. And we lived in this very small apartment. It was a one-bedroom apartment. And all four of us were in that room. And Diane could cry at night, and I would not hear her. And Johnny would cry at night, and Chuck wouldn't hear him, because we had made this arrangement, and it worked out very well. But other than that, and this has held throughout our marriage. When I'm teaching, Chuck does almost 100% of the cooking. During the summer, I work in the greenhouses, and there just is a shared labor there that isn't ever organized by schedule, but just go ahead and do it.
When you were doing that in the early 50s, did you feel that was an uncommon arrangement?
I must have, because I always considered myself very lucky in this aspect. But when I think about my good luck in this arrangement, I don't think of it so much as the roles of men and women play as the fact that how nice that Chuck enjoys cooking when I hate it so much, you know. And he didn't marry me for my housekeeping talents. That's for sure.
Well, the reason I asked that is I'm reading this book. But anyway, okay, it's just an exciting thought.
But yes, I have been very much aware of the fact that I was lucky in this aspect, and I've never had a problem at home. But in turn, I also think that I have given him the same freedom. So there's a, although there's an awareness of the roles that we play and that we mix in a way that other families don't have it, I don't think of it as any big thing. It just seems to be a very natural arrangement in our home.
Do you think this contributed to your ability to carry on your career in education?
And this is very definitely true. Chuck realized from the outset how important my career in education was to me. And if, but he has also made the comment that if I would have wanted to work just to have a job to bring in income, he probably would have tried to have influenced me more not to work away from the home, especially in the early years of our marriage. But because there were teaching opportunities open to me, he cooperated in every way where I would be able to utilize that opportunity. And of course, in our arrangement in Hot Springs, it worked out beautifully. It was also to his advantage because it was a local job. And in our first teaching situation there, it was our building on our property as well. He had the arrangement with, as far as the building, with the Department of Education. So, but I know for sure that even if we had not lived there, if we had been in Fairbanks, he would have supported me 100% in pursuing a career in education. Probably not as a dishwasher or waitress, but because he knew what education meant to me.
What did education mean to you?
Well, from the time that, as soon as I graduated from college, there was only one thing that I wanted to do and teach. I can remember we had an offer, both of us, to go to Cordova. We received a telegram when we were at Chico State, and we hadn't actually applied for jobs anywhere at that time, but we received this telegram, and there was, we wanted to teach in Cordova. Cordova wasn't accepting men and, or husband and wife, combinations in their system then for some reason. And but because of our application there, we received a telegram for a village job. And that's when I found out I was expecting Jimmy and was expecting him sometime in August. It just wasn't practical for us to accept that position. So when we did return to Fairbanks, and Jim was just a baby, and of course the other two were very small too, there was an opening at Iliamna that somebody told me about, and I would have been, I wanted that job so badly, and I can remember talking to Chuck about it, and going to see the professor of education at the university that had mentioned it, and I would just have been ready to pack up my family and just take them all there. But because it was an unfamiliar town, and Chuck didn't know what there would be for him, he didn't want me to accept it. That's the one time that he didn't. And the reason he didn't was because the full economic responsibility of the family would have rested on my teaching job, because he didn't know what there would be there for him. And he talked me out of that one, but that's the only time he ever did. And I don't think I would have ever let him talk me out of another one, even if he would have tried. He never did.
They would have accepted you doing that job?
Yes, As it turned out, the next fall, this was in the early months of 55, and then that fall. As it turned out, fate worked in its magic anyway, because if we would have gone to Iliamna, we may not have heard about the hot spring. I'm sure we wouldn't have then. And as it turned out, because we stayed in Fairbanks, we found out about the sale of the hot springs, and I'm sure that Chuck told you that story, or will tell it to you. And I did go ahead and accept a position for that school year in the Fairbanks school system. And it was in the college area. There wasn't a school there. I taught first grade in the basement of the Presbyterian Church in at the foot of the hill, and taught there for 1 year, and then came to Hot Springs with the children the day after school was out, that spring.
That spring of 56?
Uh-huh.
And Chuck had spent that winter in Hot Springs? Or?
Yes. Chuck came and spent the winter at Hot Springs to set up, build the first greenhouse there, and get ready for the season. And then I had the children and hired a girl to stay with me to take care of the children during the day. But I lived right next to the school, found a house right next to the school, so it was a very convenient arrangement. Worked out very well.
Why was it you wanted to go to Hot Springs? I mean, aside from the fact you bought the land there, but I mean, before you bought the land there, what was the appeal to you?
Well, did Chuck tell you about making the visit there in 1950?
We haven't taped that yet.
That was an off-the-record comment.
Yes, I'll let you tell the story about the Hot Springs then. And we made a trip there in 1950 over the 4th of July weekend. And, Kurt, you needn't ask me that question. You only need to make a trip to Hot Springs to know that if that a property is available, you're going to... it's an opportunity that comes to few in a lifetime.
Yeah, but some people will notice certain things more than others. And you may have noticed it for its greenhouse potential, or maybe for its, just its beauty, or
for its warmth, or
for its everything. It's just an incredible property. You know, it's just the location and the potential of a unique property, especially in an Arctic land. At that time, there was no reason for us to believe that that property would be available for us in 5 years. And I can remember walking on in that area and saying, you know, if you had a dream come true, it would be to have a place like this someday. And suddenly, 5 years later, it was ours. And I can say honestly, after being there for 23 years, I can say the same thing today, and even more so. Every now and then, and this has happened so many times in the years that we've been there, you know, that how could we be so lucky as to have gotten this property, and that's the way I feel. That land just is very special to me.
Do you feel really responsible to it, caring for it?
Ask my husband. it's just an indescribable feeling when you know that there's a piece of land that is so much a part of you. I can't think of being in another place or doing another thing without knowing that my roots, and not having my roots in Hot Springs. In other words, I couldn't give it up for any price. Ask Chuck.
I know. But you know, at least you know now we want to get your side of everything. So,
in your words.
Let's see. So, finished Fairbanks and you moved to Hot Springs in '56. What was there then?
Well, that winter there had been a population of 15 there, and it was old-timers and childless couples. There was a family there, one family that did have small children. They were the same age as our two youngest ones. But as soon as families with children who had reached school age, they would leave Hot Springs because they didn't have a school there. So there was this one family that had the two children, one under 2 years and one 3 years old that was there. And then there was a teenager, but she was an adopted daughter of the NC store managers. And of course the year of 56 was the big flood. And of course we didn't get there until after the flood was over, because we came in the last part of May, and the flood occurred a couple of weeks before that. When we arrived, the bridge was gone, so we ferried back and forth across the slough to the property, and people were recovering from that, the tremendous damage that the flood caused.
How did you get to Hot Springs? What was your transportation?
The only way you could go in those days was fly, because the river boats didn't carry passengers, and there was no road between Livengood and Eureka. That didn't come until 3 years later. So your only transportation was flying. But though in those days we did have the bush pilot station there like we do now. But the bush pilot, the local bush pilot, was much more active. And well, Frank Jones, Bob Byers, was the bush pilot there, but he was the one that we bought the property from. And he had sold out and moved to Fairbanks and then later to the state of Washington. He's in Kent, Washington now. He sold out to Frank Jones. So Frank Jones was there when we got there. And he was a fellow that had gone to the University of Alaska with us. So we knew him slightly. We didn't ever know him well at the university, but we knew who he was. And since that time, there have been others there. But it's the certificate that Cy Hetherington holds now. But the service there was on an unscheduled basis, but with very frequent flights almost every day. And in the summer times, more than that. I mean, the main occupation of the bush pilot there was his flying. Cy Hetherington expanded the business to include more than that. So I used to tell people when they used to ask me about life was in Hot Springs in contrast to Fairbanks. The biggest adjustment that I had to make with as far as responsibility toward the family was concerned was the ability to plan a year ahead as far as your needs were concerned. Because, of course, to fly in your food by plane was just too expensive. So what you did was you ordered in bulk, and we used to order from Seattle. The Commission House, I remember, was one source that we used. And you would order all of those materials a year in advance. So you would only buy from Fairbanks or the local store. Your produce, of course, would come from Fairbanks. Those supplies that you were perishable or that you needed in such small amounts that you wouldn't buy them by the case. But never having had to do that, to order for my own family in such huge amounts so far in advance, that was the biggest lesson that I had to learn quickly. And then the biggest concern that I had as a mother of three small children was how to handle emergencies with them. And that always did hang heavy over my head was their health or in sickness. What would happen if there would be a medical emergency and a pilot would not be able to take off. But we were fortunate in that sense because our children were healthy.
Did you ever have any near emergencies? Things that really worried you in that regard?
No, there were times when we had a sickness, but it was at a time when it was convenient to fly in. So I was never confronted with that. There were a couple of bad spills. An accident that Diane had at school where she had a fracture in the arm that was very slight, but it was coincidental. In fact, we thought it was no more than just a heavy bruise. And because if somebody crashed into her arm while they were playing a game similar to soccer, you know. But just coincidentally, there happened to be a doctor in town, and he asked to see it, and he suggested that she go in and have it x-rayed. He thought she had a slight fracture, which she did, you know, lengthwise. And once she spilled and hurt her tailbone. But in both of those instances, it wasn't one where a child is lying in bed with a very high fever and the doctor can't get out type thing, you know.
Did you keep first aid and medical supplies in your house?
Well, just the standard type things. In Diane, like in Diane's case, when the doctor did look at her, he looked through my supplies and he saw the type of gauze that has the plaster on it, and all you have to do is wet it, and it turns into a cast. And so he made a cast for her. As far as keeping a supply of drugs on hand, like some people when they go out into the bush will ask for doctors to give them a basic supply. I, not really, no.
You have sutures?
Butterflies. Not sutures. We were also very fortunate when we first arrived there. The fellow who owned the roadhouse, Lloyd Hubbard, his wife was an excellent, excellent nurse. And then later on, Bertie Mason, who was the ex-missionary nurse that lived at the end of town, she was another excellent nurse. In fact, she had even extracted teeth and done minor surgery when she was in charge of the hospital at Fort Yukon. So when they were there, I felt comfortable. But it was in those periods when there weren't any nurses there.
Was it a problem for the kids growing up with very few other kids around to play with?
Well, my children were fortunate in having the one other family where there were the two children that were the age of the two younger ones in our family. And then when we moved there in the spring of 56, in 58, suddenly there were 10 children that, because Stanley Dale married and his wife had children by a previous marriage. So, and Horace and Harriet Roberts moved up from Tanana, and they had Linda, who was ready for the first grade. So suddenly we had 10 children and enough to start a special school. Bill Burke also moved in, and he had all of his children. He moved into town when Lina realized that her illness had reached the stage where she could no longer teach her children at home and take care of them and would require medical attention. And of course, she passed away. She never really actually lived in Hot Springs because she passed away in September. So the children weren't there that long with no other children to play with. There were at least one, two, or three children there, at least two children there from the time that they were there. But I'm sure that they would have benefited by more children to play with. I can remember my Diane saying she learned how to read, and she really was books meant a lot for her, and her making the remark that some of her best friends had already lived or were never born, and she was referring to the friends that she found in her books.
Did you and Chuck, well, since you really visit with people and are really outgoing people, did you miss not having too many people around you, or did you feel that there was plenty of company and family for you?
Well, even though there were that few number of people, the first year, 15 sounds like a small number. But from there on, it was upward. And we always did have a lot of company. We also have had visitors from out of town that have come and stayed with us, some for days, some for weeks, some for all summer type of thing. And I've never for once have I felt lonesome or lonely. Not at any time. As a matter of fact, I think we've often made the statement, or I have, that there, with the road closing in the wintertime and then opening from May to October, that it's just a beautiful balance. Because summers we have a lot of people in and out of the house all the time. It's not that common for us to sit down and have supper together. In fact, I remember Chuck saying that once. He said, "Do you realize that we're going to have supper together?" I said, and this was about mid-afternoon. And I said, "Well, it might be a little early to say that." And before supper was over that night, we had fed 13. Of course, this didn't happen every day, but this wasn't. It was an indication of we did have people in and out of the house a lot, and a lot of it was unplanned company. And in the summer times, you really look forward to that. By the time fall came around, you were glad for the road closing and things quieting down. And come spring again, you were looking forward to the company again. So it kind of balanced out well that way. But, of course, all of those years I taught, too. And come September, that's when my busy time at school began. And come May, school closed, and then we were right into the heavy season as far as the farm was concerned. They've often said, "What do you do living out in a small place like this? What do you do with your time?" And you generally just give a very non-committal answer. But there hasn't been a winter yet long enough that I have been able to do all of those things that I put aside that I'm going to do when next winter comes, you know.
Like, what sort of things would you put aside?
Well, for one thing, the things that you do for pleasure. I haven't done any sculpting like I thought I would have all kinds of time for. Sewing, I don't get to at all. The type of activities that any type of handiwork, like when I was when the children were small, just the sewing would take a considerable bit of your time, although I never did do things like knitting or crocheting. But just, I do love to do beadwork, however. Skin sewing, I enjoy. But the other type of sewing that women generally do, I don't do. I darn and I do skin sewing and beadwork. And that's it in that category. But also things around the house that you don't like to do in the summertime because you want to spend all of that time outside or with the greenhouses. You wait, you know, put it aside until wintertime.
So in the wintertime, since you wouldn't have time to do these things that you wanted to do, what would it be that you would spend your time doing?
Of course, I was teaching. And teaching, of course, took up all of that time. When the children were small, what I mentioned that Chuck would do almost 100% of the cooking, and that was the cooking of the meals. But on weekends, I used to do the baking. So I used to bake for the next week and do the washing. So, and since I also have taught every year since 1958, there really haven't been, there hasn't been the time to do more than staying on top of things. I didn't have that much free time in the wintertime. I would, Christmas vacation would give me time to relax. Since the children have grown up, my weekends have been freer because there isn't the amount of time taken up taking care of or baking for two or cleaning for two that you would have for a family of five.
Were there any special circumstances because of living in the hot springs that would take your time that living someplace else you wouldn't have to do?
The years when we went, yeah, if you were living in Fairbanks, I wouldn't bake as much if I were living in Fairbanks as I would in Hot Springs. Also in Hot Springs, living in a small town like that, you're involved in all things as a community as a whole. We would have fundraising activities for certain things that there was a very strong community spirit, you know, which Hot Springs has had, you know, our weekly movies are, this is something that we've planned since 56, the first year we were there. We worked toward weekly community movies. And these would have to be supplemented with fundraising projects because your attendance wasn't sufficient to pay for the movies at any time, you know. Also, other type of community activities, maybe just to help one person out at a time. There were, you also did much of your entertaining centered around dinner parties in a small town like that. And of course, when we first moved there, there were a greater number of bachelors. And
so, because these people are bachelors, you'd have them over for dinner?
Yeah.